or have another print disability which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Kathy, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the January 4th issue of the New York Times Business Section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. NPR Chief Was a Target, Then the Real Trouble Started, by Benjamin Mullen. Catherine Marr knew that running NPR was going to be difficult. But since taking over as chief executive in 2024, she has confronted one crisis after another. Right-wing activists found her old posts on social media and tried to get her fired. Congress stripped more than $500 million in annual funding from public media. She has become a target not just of NPR's traditional opponents on the political right, but of some within the tight-knit world of public broadcasting who wanted her to take a more pragmatic tack. At one point, the chief executive of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, one of NPR's biggest supporters, told Ms. Marr she should quit. Her predecessors were accused of bringing a tote bag to a knife fight during political attacks on the organization. Ms. Marr, by contrast, has been more aggressive, refusing to compromise with Congress and taking the Trump administration to court along with a key ally. Ms. Marr, 42, stood by her strategy. The government targeted public funding to punish specific editorial decisions it disagreed with, she said in a recent interview with the New York Times. That's not a funding dispute dressed up as a constitutional case. That's textbook First Amendment retaliation. Ms. Marr's stance brought support pouring in for her organization. NPR emerged from the biggest political battle in its history on firm footing, generating record donations. But the loss of roughly $500 million from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been devastating for other parts of the public media universe. Many local stations, which pay dues to NPR and PBS, are laying off employees. In other words, Ms. Marr and NPR have managed to hold on to their influence over public broadcasting this past year, even as that system was dealt a terrible blow and is far weaker overall. Yet there are emerging challenges to NPR's sway over public radio. In the wake of the funding fight, a coalition of public media organizations has teamed up to form Public Media Infrastructure, an organization that could eventually provide an alternative to a radio distribution system managed by NPR. When I came into this organization, we talked about the first 50 years of public media and the next 50 years, Ms. Marr said in the interview. Nobody expected there to be quite as fine a point on it as this moment in time. She did her homework. Running NPR is a notoriously difficult job. It's one part politician, managing relationships with hundreds of stations, one part turnaround artist, trying to expand a business with roots in traditional radio, and one part fundraiser, appealing to foundations and other donors. And NPR's most important product is its journalism, which its chief executive has no direct control over. Further complicating matters, NPR is a nonprofit with a majority of its board of directors from local stations who occasionally have diverging interests. Over the past 15 years, NPR has had seven chief executives. NPR's board members were excited in the fall of 2023 when they found Ms. Marr. She had worked for the World Bank and HSBC. As the chief executive of the nonprofit that runs Wikipedia, she oversaw a sprawling, complicated community of volunteer editors, and she was prepared. She had done her homework, said Jennifer Farrow, the former chair of NPR's board who led the search committee. In some ways, Ms. Marr was an unusual pick. She had no experience running a professional news organization. And unlike NPR's recent top leaders, who were media executives in the twilight of their careers, Ms. Marr was relatively young and knew the tech world. She was also telegenic, eventually breezing through interviews with late-night hosts like Stephen Colbert and Jordan Klepper. I barter these for groceries, she said, presented with a Daily Show tote bag. During one of the most consequential times in NPR's history, Ms. Maher has been a highly visible CEO, holding conference calls with station leaders and delivering direct-to-camera fundraising appeals. Ms. Maher has been visiting NPR stations with recent trips to Bloomington, Indiana, and Thousand Oaks, California. It'll take me 5 years to get to all of them, she said. While she is out on maternity leave, NPR's chief financial officer, Daphne Kwan, will fill in as interim president. In early 2024, 2 weeks after she started, Ms. Maher and NPR faced an unexpected crisis. Yuri Berliner, a senior editor at NPR, published an essay in the Free Press accusing the network of a liberal bias in its news coverage. The crisis deepened a week later. Chris Rufo, the conservative activist who ran social media campaigns against figures including Claudine Gay, the former Harvard president, circulated years-old social media posts from Ms. Maher that criticized Donald J. Trump and supported liberal causes. Also, Donald Trump is a racist, read one. NPR's critics seized the moment. In early May, Republicans in Congress called on Ms. Maher to testify on allegations of bias. In addition, some at NPR were surprised by Ms. Maher's social media posts. She told The Times that the board hadn't asked her about them before she was hired. Steve Inskeep, a host of Morning Edition, published a rebuttal to Mr. Berliner's essay, accusing him of errors. NPR noted in a statement that Ms. Maher wrote her posts before she joined the news industry. Did she consider quitting? I really don't like bullies, she said. She remembered thinking, my view is that the overall goal of what I was brought in to do was far greater than that 5 week mark. Ms. Farrow, who was in touch with Mr. Maher frequently during that period, was determined to keep her at NPR. She was the right leader, she said, and she believed getting rid of an executive because of political pressure 40 days after she joined would only weaken the organization. The furor surrounding her posts subsided, but they would come up again. An asteroid looms. In November 2024, weeks after Mr. Trump was elected, an ominous memo on the impact of federal defunding, written by two public media leaders, began circulating among station directors. It raised the possibility that Congress could eventually claw back all funding for NPR and PBS. This is a scenario akin to an asteroid striking without warning, the report said. It included a diagram showing that money from Congress is allocated to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which then doles it out to NPR, PBS, and local stations across the United States. For NPR and PBS, defunding would be survivable. Most of NPR's revenue comes from membership dues, sponsorships, and donations. But for local stations, many of which rely on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting for a majority of their budget, this was catastrophic. In March, Ms. Maher and Paula Kerger, the chief executive of PBS, were called to testify before Congress in a hearing whose title seemed to presage its conclusion, Anti-American Airwaves, Accountability for the Heads of NPR and PBS. The hearing was divided along partisan lines. The Republicans, who argued that NPR and PBS were outmoded, a waste of taxpayer money, or liberally biased, interrogated Ms. Kerger and Ms. Maher, asking the NPR chief executive about her social media posts and the network's coverage of Hunter Biden's laptop. The Democrats praised NPR and PBS and mocked the proceedings. Is Elmo now, or has he ever been, a member of the Communist Party? The hearing made it clear that Republicans in Congress, which had tried to pull NPR's funding for a half century, might finally make good on their threat. Strains over a compromise. In April, as Congress was gearing up to claw back funding from the public media system, America's Public Television Stations, a nonprofit advocacy group, sent a document to leaders of NPR, PBS, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The document listed several scenarios that might allow NPR and PBS to save funding for local stations by agreeing to give up money for national programs. It even included a safe-faced rationale for some Republicans in Congress who wanted to justify their support of public media. How big of a cut could we tolerate? The document asked. At a meeting soon after, Ms. Kerger and Ms. Maher expressed support for such a compromise. It seemed, briefly, like the heaviest hitters in public broadcasting were on board with the plan. But there were also signs of major strain. On a call last spring, Patricia Harrison, the chief executive of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, asked Ms. Maher whether she would be willing to say anything to Congress or the news media to acknowledge concerns from listeners who viewed NPR's reporting as biased, according to two people familiar with her remarks. Ms. Maher rebuffed that suggestion. She didn't believe that NPR was biased, and she thought saying so would undermine the organization and fail to placate those who were critical of the network, according to a person familiar with her thinking. After she refused, months of simmering tension between the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and NPR came to the surface. Ms. Harrison told Ms. Maher she should resign her position for the good of public media. Things got more tense on May 1st when Mr. Trump issued an executive order banning government funding of NPR and PBS. NPR sued the White House, arguing that that order violated the Constitution. And it added the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as a defendant, since Mr. Trump's order directed it to deny NPR funding. NPR also changed its position on the funding compromise. It now viewed any cuts as a violation of the First Amendment, essentially arguing that cuts amounted to government discrimination against NPR based on its viewpoint. Ms. Maher said that once the Trump administration attempted to tie the organization's ability to receive federal funding to its editorial decisions, the compromise was no longer an option. In July, the Senate officially voted to defund public media, 51-48. In a somber meeting with employees days after the vote, Ms. Maher said NPR and its member stations had waged a David and Goliath-style fight that included 191 meetings during a trip to Washington, D.C., 40 of which were directly with elected officials. "We put up a really good fight as a team, as an organization, as a network, and we should be damn proud of it," she said. She also appeared in a fundraising appeal from NPR. "We need your help," she said. Donations poured in. Then the Corporation for Public Broadcasting took a step that ratcheted up tension with NPR. For years, the corporation had funded a radio distribution system managed by NPR. Instead, in September, it announced it was awarding a major grant to Public Media Infrastructure, the new entity formed by a group of five public media organizations, including WNYC, PRX, and the Station Resource Group. After that, the legal battle between NPR and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting erupted. Mom and Dad are fighting. In late September, NPR's board of directors gathered on a video call to discuss a highly unusual move championed by Ms. Maher, seeking a restraining order against public radio's biggest supporter. The situation was complicated. NPR had already sued the Corporation for Public Broadcasting alongside the Trump administration, but the restraining order went further. In court, NPR would argue that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting had changed its mind about funding a radio distribution system managed by NPR because Mr. Trump issued his order in May, essentially helping him violate the First Amendment. The restraining order sought to keep the funding from going elsewhere. The corporation, for its part, argued that it had funded the new entity because NPR had a monopoly over its radio distribution grants, and it wanted those efforts to be more independent. It also told a judge it was acting on an independent recommendation that predated the funding fight. At stake were millions of dollars and the possibility of widening the rift between NPR and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. As one public media executive put it at the time, "Mom and Dad are fighting." In the end, three members of NPR's 23-person board of directors voted against the restraining order or abstained from voting. Ms. Maher had rallied the board with a speech about the importance of standing firm on First Amendment issues. The legal action inflamed a painful internecine battle as emails from NPR and the corporation became public in discovery. There is a dream scenario. We get the money and CPB goes away by the action of Congress, wrote one NPR executive, referring to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in April. In one email, an executive with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting suggested that the organization hadn't funded an NPR project because of the political challenges that came with doing so, although they couldn't own it in public. In November, the two sides reached a settlement, with the corporation agreeing to direct some of its remaining funding toward the satellite system managed by NPR and declaring Mr. Trump's executive order unconstitutional. Both sides issued statements declaring victory, with NPR citing a judge's remarks stating that the organization had made a very substantial showing to support its argument. In tandem with the settlement, Ms. Maher decided that NPR would give stations relief on some of their fees, earning her some goodwill among station managers across the country. But a bigger chunk of money was gone. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting is scheduled to wind down this month. You have to make a decision. Though the public broadcasting system is reeling, NPR's business remains stable. Ms. Maher said that that NPR was expected to generate record donations for 2025 and would deliver $22 million in financial support to members of its network, which has around 200 newsrooms. Local stations' fundraising has also increased. While the web traffic to NPR.org declined this past year, according to ComScore, a spokeswoman for NPR said the network's total digital reach was up, factoring in platforms like YouTube, where NPR's Tiny Desk concerts are popular. And NPR's broadcast audience has increased roughly 8% over this past year, according to Radio Research Consortium. The end of government support has raised questions about the future of public radio, with some stations choosing to disaffiliate with NPR and PBS entirely. Ms. Maher borrowed an analogy from a station manager, comparing public broadcasters to a family that now has to figure out where to host Thanksgiving after the loss of a parent. Now you have a decision as a family. Do you still want to come together every year for the dinner party? Ms. Maher asked. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The gray market drugs flooding the tech scene. For some Silicon Valley risk takers, Chinese peptides are the latest body hack, by Jasmine Sun. Despite risks, tech world embraces untested drugs, bypassing regulators and medical advice for the unproven potential of Chinese peptides. Jaden Clark first heard about Chinese peptides at his 4th of July party this past year. In the backyard of a San Francisco Victorian, tech workers in their 20s and 30s chatted against the backdrop of sunshine, grilled meats, and a big American flag. One artificial intelligence founder mentioned buying cheap drugs directly from Chinese manufacturers. A group soon formed around him, jumping into the conversation to share their own sources for the medications they use for weight loss, productivity, and fitness. Mr. Clark, 27, had lived through several injection crazes in the bodybuilding community. He's a self-proclaimed gym bro who posts under the X username at creatine_cycle, but was surprised to hear them talked about by the AI crowd. Something I've learned over this long weekend in San Francisco is that the elites all have a Chinese peptide dealer, Mr. Clark, who hosts a podcast on tech culture, posted on X. The term Chinese peptides quickly became a meme. Gray market peptides have flooded some corners of the tech scene recently, showing up in hacker houses, startup offices, and even peptide raves sponsored by suppliers. One recent event at Frontier Town in San Francisco featured a mix-your-own peptides workshop, a DJ playing techno with chemistry structures projected in the background, and a dress code calling for crazy, futuristic cyberpunk attire. Peptides are short chains of amino acids that regulate hormones and reduce inflammation in the human body. They are best known as the P in GLP-1s, the class of drugs that includes Ozempic and Wegovy, which have transformed the weight loss industry by mimicking a hormone that suppresses appetite. But on Silicon Valley's frontiers, a wider array of unproven, unregulated peptides has taken hold. People are trying BPC-157 and TB-500 for healing injuries by stimulating new blood vessel growth, oxytocin for improving eye contact. One OpenAI researcher calls it Ozempic for autism, Epitalon for sleep, and Retatrutide, a next-generation weight loss drug still in clinical trials, for everything from appetite suppressant to increased focus. According to U.S. Customs data, imports of hormone and peptide compounds from China roughly doubled to $328 million in the first three quarters of 2025, from $164 million in the same period of 2024. This includes demand for GLPs, Melantoin 2, and other peptides from compounding pharmacies and gray market suppliers. Aside from the GLP-1s for weight loss, none have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration to sell for human use. Pharmaceutical companies have been reluctant to invest in peptide trials, given that most are easy to manufacture and don't directly target a disease. These conditions have fostered a thriving gray market. At one Manhattan meetup of biohackers, people who experiment with regimens and supplements to improve their body's performance, each week someone will bring something new and everyone will inject it, said David Peterson, a tech investor and co-founder of the logistics unicorn Flexport. It looks like a bunch of heroin addicts, he joked. He has been using peptides since 2018 and credits Epitalon with adding an hour and a half of sleep and melanotan, which increases melanin production, with curing his rosacea. The FDA has warned that many peptides pose serious safety risks because of potential impurities and immune reactions. It has also barred pharmacies from compounding them, though enforcement is uneven. Personal use is legal, though most doctors advised against it. It's unfounded and reckless, said Eric Topol, director of the Scripps Research Translational Institute, a research center focused on individualized medicine. Experimental peptide injections occasionally result in medical emergencies. In July, two women were hospitalized with swollen tongues, breathing difficulties, and an increased heart rate after getting peptide injections at an anti-aging festival in Las Vegas. It's unclear what specific peptides they received. Still, for some in the tech world, using peptides is a form of faith in the possibility of infinite self-optimization. Mr. Clark said peptides, to some, offer tantalizing shortcuts. Why be really consistent at the gym for 6 weeks if I could instead work 16 hours at my research job? But it also reveals a Silicon Valley mindset in which some believe that, as innovators shaping our world, they don't need guidance from federal regulators or medical doctors because they're doing their own experimentation for research use only. The drugs can be purchased directly from factories in China, the world's peptide manufacturing hub, or through the websites of American intermediaries that import and test them. They arrive in powders and vials labeled for research use only, but the warning is a thin legal fiction. Users mix the peptides with sterile water and inject themselves, often with insulin syringes bought from Amazon. The economics of off-market peptides are undoubtedly appealing. Prescription GLPs like Ozempic, Semaglutide, and Zepbound, Tirzepatide, could cost more than $1,000 per month until fairly recently, while the research use equivalents went for one-fifth the cost. Our average customer is closer to a Starbucks barista, said a San Francisco-based supplier of Chinese peptides who spoke on the condition of anonymity because it is unlawful for suppliers to market them for human use. But the techies were the first on this because of the willingness to take ridiculous risks. He observed that one person at a tech company would start using peptides, kicking off a cluster of users. It always starts with the CEOs, then CTOs, then the COOs. A lot of hardware people are into it. Biopharma people are shockingly the most reserved. They're a little too deferential to the FDA. Online advertising of unauthorized peptide formulations grew nearly eightfold from 2022 to 2024, said Gerald Olson, director of research at LegitScript, a firm that tracks problematic online marketing of pharmaceutical and other products. Dr. Paul Abramson, concierge doctor in San Francisco, said he had seen a big uptick in peptide use in 2025, especially among young men in the tech industry. While weight loss is still the most popular driver of peptide use, patients are microdosing, taking very small amounts of GLPs with the hope that it will help them combat other vices, alcoholism, excessive video game playing, or online shopping. There are no clinical trials supporting microdosing, though anecdotal accounts are enticing to some. It just seems to be this obsession with cognitive maxing, said Mr. Clark, who remains a peptide skeptic. Anelia Grant, 41, is a co-founder of an AI billing startup by day and an amateur peptide blogger by night. She began microdosing Semaglutide in 2023 when a friend suggested that it could mitigate work-induced stress eating. She said it was so effective that she had dived into a rabbit hole of personal peptide research. After consulting a sports performance doctor, Ms. Grant added 5 more peptides to her regimen: MOTS-C, Epitalon, GHK-CU, Ipamorelin, and Kisspeptin-10. Their hoped-for health benefits included better metabolism, muscle growth, skin, sleep, energy, and hormone regulation. She orders them directly from Chinese manufacturers, which charge $50 to $100 per kit, one-tenth what FDA-approved U.S. labs charge, then pays an extra $250 to send them to Genoshik Analytics, a lab in the Czech Republic, for purity testing. Asked if she had any background in biology, she laughed. Absolutely no, she said. Like many fellow peptide enthusiasts, she gets her information primarily from word-of-mouth testimonials, Reddit threads, podcasts, and conversations with ChatGPT. It's another thing I can tweak in addition to my SEO, she said. Several other founders analogized their openness to untested peptides to their tolerance for business risk. Dr. Abramson, whom Ms. Grant interviewed for a post on her blog, was less convinced. The entrepreneurial parallel isn't funding a scrappy startup, he said to her. It's wiring money to an unregistered offshore entity based on a pitch deck. Unfounded and reckless. Dr. Topol, who has covered these trends in his Substack newsletter about medical misinformation, worries that people are extrapolating from the success of GLP-1s to dozens of untested, unrelated peptides, exposing themselves to contamination and long-term health risks in the process. Do your own research has lots of dangers, Dr. Topol said. If they really were good citizen scientists, they would know what the criteria are. Randomized, placebo-controlled trials. Peer-reviewed publications independent of the company. We don't have any of those studies for most of these peptides. Dr. Topol identifies the root cause of such amateur biohacking as growing distrust of the medical establishment, especially after the COVID-19 pandemic. Where people have lost trust in the FDA, wellness influencers like Andrew Huberman and Joe Rogan have brought experimental peptide use into the mainstream. In Mr. Rogan's case, while being sponsored by Ways to Well, a company selling clinician-supervised peptide therapy. In an ex post in October 2024, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is now Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, pledged to end the aggressive suppression of peptides. The FDA under President Joseph R. Biden Jr. took enforcement against action against some peptide sellers. But while the Trump administration has approved Wegovy's pill form after adding oral GLP-1s to the FDA's priority review list, it hasn't taken action to deregulate other types of peptides. An HHS spokesperson said the agency cannot comment on future policy decisions. Most peptide enthusiasts, though, relished experimenting on their body like a research subject. Brooke Bowman, 38, is the bushy-haired, fast-talking chief executive of Vibe Camp, an annual gathering of the rationalist and post-rationalist communities. These groups are interested in metacognition, or improving the art of thinking itself, a proclivity that makes them especially interested in mind-enhancing substances. She considers herself a transhumanist, someone who believes in using technology to augment human abilities, and even got an RFID chip implanted in her hand to link her to her Telegram profile when tapped. The chip, which she got at a human augmentation dance party, was installed too deep and doesn't work. Ms. Bowman started taking BPC-157 and TB-500 in 2025, hoping to address chronic fatigue, and said her sleep had improved right away. She logs her injections in the Peptide Tracker app, monitors her sleep and heart rate, and gets blood work done regularly. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In August, Ms. Bowman added retatritude, not to lose weight, but for its potential cognitive benefits and to help her quit vaping. She said the peptide helped reduce nicotine cravings, but one day she accidentally doubled her dose. "My hair started falling out after a month because I was malnourished," Ms. Bowman said. "It made my heart rate go up 10 beats per minute at night." Still, she plans to keep going. Ms. Bowman never thought she would use syringes again. In 2020, she got clean from an addiction to recreational drugs. Peptides changed that. "I'm a bit of an adrenaline junkie, and I'm not getting that from crystal meth anymore, so it's fun to have a new thing I'm experimenting with that isn't horrible," she said. Another shipment of her Chinese peptides was on its way. Let the crazy people try. One 29-year-old startup founder had been taking prescription GLP-1s for nearly 2 years. Her weight dropped, but it came with frequent depressive swings. "I couldn't get out of bed and work," she said. She spoke on the condition of anonymity because she worried that her use of the drugs would affect her career prospects. Biohackers who are addressing their productivity generally seemed more comfortable speaking publicly than those trying to lose weight, suggesting more stigma around the latter. In May, she attended a GLP-1 session at a rationalist conference where several attendees suggested that retatritude, which is still in phase 3 clinical trials, might fix her mood swings through its stimulant effects. She switched from Zepbound to retatritude and learned how to mix her own peptides via TikTok influencers and a viral DIY guide by the Substacker Cremo. For the startup founder, the health benefits of weight loss were greater than the risks. She said she felt professional pressure to look good on camera. "I've been watching a ton of launch videos," she said. "I definitely notice now that founders aren't overweight." Several off-label peptide users, including that founder, expressed excitement about what they saw as the Trump administration's relatively laissez-faire approach to drug regulation. It echoes the sentiment of Silicon Valley leaders such as Balaji Srinivasan and Joe Lonsdale, who have accused FDA regulators of being overly cautious. Medical experts are frustrated by this mindset. "The point of the FDA is to protect patients and consumers from shady medical entrepreneurs who would sell unsuspecting people dangerous things," said Dr. Aaron Kesselheim, a professor at Harvard Medical School, an expert on medical regulation. "I think these people are doing things that are bad for their health based on the evidence, which is that there is none." But from the startup founder's point of view, we might all be better off if we let the crazy people try the crazy peptides and filter down to the rest of us, instead of the system, which takes 10 years and is meant to protect everyone from everything. A gym evolves. Colin Keating, Chief Executive, Planet Fitness. She wants to maintain the company's judgment-free zone, no intimidation sense of community, while adding weight training equipment and other services people want. It's hard to scroll through social media these days without a gymfluencer telling you about the benefits of lifting weights and eating more protein. These messages have changed the way Americans think about fitness and wellness. Cardio, once the king of exercise, is being supplanted by weightlifting sessions. Planet Fitness, one of the largest gym chains in the world, has long billed itself as a place for exercise novices. Now it is trying to respond to the rising popularity of strength training by redesigning its space and adding more weights and resistance machines. On a recent tour at the company's headquarters in Hampton, New Hampshire, Colleen Keating, the chief executive, walked past the old faithful treadmills and pointed to the dumbbells and weight machines people use for chest presses and to build their quads, glutes, and hamstrings. "A couple of years ago, we did not have rigs and racks in our gyms," said Ms. Keating, who took the top job in June 2024 after a career in hospitality, including as chief executive of First Key Homes, a rental home property company. "We used to be a bit more cardio forward, and now we're dedicating about half the gym floor to strength and about half the club floor to cardio." The changes may shift how people think about Planet Fitness, which has nearly 2,800 locations and about 21 million members. So might the membership fee, which in the summer of 2024 increased to $15 a month. Still cheaper than some sweet green salads, but a 50% jump from the $10 it had been for decades. The higher fee hasn't been bad for business, though. In the company's most recent quarter, total revenue increased 13%. Its share price is also up by more than 30% in the past 5 years. "It's really important that we convey that, yes, you can get strong at Planet Fitness," Ms. Keating, 57, said. This interview, conducted in December, has been edited and condensed. How would you describe the health and wellness craze right now? We're in the golden age of fitness. When I was growing up, I don't remember seeing my parents go to the gym or my friends' parents go to the gym. I had one friend whose dad jogged. Young people today are growing up watching their parents have fitness as part of their lifestyle. Gen Z is the fastest growing segment of our membership. Did the company's shift to more strength training workouts have anything to do with the fact that people weren't thinking about Planet Fitness as a place for that? It's not that we are moving entirely to strength. It was the right balance of cardio and strength and shifting the gym floor so that people could accomplish the workout that they desired. We needed to convey that we're a gym for all fitness levels. One of the things that makes us special is that judgment-free zone, no gym intimidation sense of community. How do you make sure the changes you're making are not intimidating to the people who just want to get on a treadmill? If you're looking to come in and walk on a treadmill, you don't have to walk through the area where the Smith machines are. These devices, used for weightlifting, have a barbell fixed to vertical tracks. In our clubs, you're always going to see somebody who looks like they're doing the kind of workout that you're doing. We don't offer paid training, but we have a trainer who is there to support members and help them get acclimated if they want to use a new piece of equipment. More people are using GLP-1s. Has that changed what people want in a workout regimen? We don't capture medical data on our members, but I think as people take GLP-1s and are starting to feel a greater sense of agility or have less joint pain because they're losing some weight, then they start to think about joining a gym. We are a comfortable place for a first-time gym goer. Who do you think you're competing with now? Is it still the couch, as Planet Fitness like to say, or is it the more boutique gyms? I think less the couch because people are more fitness aware than ever. People are wearing a wearable, counting their steps, even if they're not a gym member. I feel like our biggest competition is the fear of walking in the front door. How do you keep prices low while adding the equipment and services that people want? There are things that we don't offer. We don't have juice bars. We don't have towel service. We don't have daycare centers. Is there something members have asked for that Planet Fitness needs to carefully consider because you want to keep prices low? One of the things we are testing in a number of clubs is personal training. Some members have indicated they'd like paid personal training. We also have to be careful that it doesn't create a gym-timidating environment. At Planet Fitness' recent Investor Day, you shared that some teenagers are referring to the company as PFIT. Is Planet Fitness trying to become a third space for that generation? I think we've always been a third space. This is such a part of people like, I need food, I need water, and I need fitness. I think you're right about Gen Z and its potentially being the third space, because they value that sense of community with their friends. In the past, Planet Fitness has said that 60% of your members go to the gym only once or twice a month. Is the company seeing changes in the frequency of people coming in? We're up in 2025. Members who utilize our club are using it on average 6.7 times a month. Tell me about your upbringing. I grew up in Connecticut. I'm a New Englander, even though I've moved around a bit. My dad was a mechanical engineer for a big aerospace company. My mom was a stay-at-home mom for the early years and then worked part-time when we were a little bit older. There was a moment in time when I thought maybe I wanted to be an airline pilot, and then I got into, I think, an adjacent business with tourism and hospitality. Let's talk about your path to the C-suite. I started in sales and marketing and revenue, so very customer-focused from my early days. I wanted to be a general manager and raised my hand and took my first general manager role at Starwood Hotels. I think it's important to put ourselves in situations where we have more questions than answers. Is there an experience during those days that was formative to your leadership? A pivotal moment was my last director of sales job before I became GM. I went in on a Sunday morning to do some catch-up, and there was a sea of linen as far as the eye could see. I poked my head into the laundry where all of the laundry team members were working, and I remember thinking, oh my gosh, can you imagine if you're doing load after load of linen and you look out and it feels like there's still mounds and mounds? I said, can I help you guys? They said yes. Instead of going to my office, I spent the day washing linen. If you've ever lifted wet linen, it's really heavy. It was really hard work. It was a turning point for me. I was like, gosh, I want to be a general manager because I would like to have the opportunity to lead. You took over Planet Fitness's longtime chief executive, Chris Rondo. What was your approach to gaining trust with employees who were used to seeing the same person lead the company for years? When I started at Planet Fitness, I spent time in our clubs talking to members. I heard a lot of feedback that helped shape the strategy. I do a small lunch once a month with team members from different cross-functional areas of business to hear feedback about what's going well and what we can improve upon. Lightning round. What's your favorite workout routine? I'm on the treadmill for a half hour, then I'll get on the climber because I need a little resistance training and toning. So 10 minutes on the climber, and then I do a weight workout. What's the heaviest that you can bench? Oh gosh, I think I'd be ashamed to share. There's no judgment here. What's your favorite time of the day to work out? Morning. There's a protein craze right now. Do you think protein is that important? If I don't eat protein, I get hungry. I particularly like protein at lunch because it fuels me for the afternoon. What is your pet peeve at the gym? I don't want to see somebody else's sweat drips. What is your biggest pet peeve as CEO? It's my biggest pet peeve in life. I don't like running late. Be on time. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times Business section on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Retiring by Mark Miller. Seven numbers shaping the landscape going forward. For some, savings are rising, but for many, so are healthcare costs and poverty. America is aging fast. By 2030, one in five Americans will be 65 or older. And by 2034, older Americans will outnumber children for the first time, according to the Census Bureau. This year, the oldest baby boomers turn 80. That demographic shift is reshaping a vast share of the U.S. economy, from participation in the labor force to retirement savings, Social Security, and Medicare outlays, healthcare spending, housing, and financial services. Retirement is one of the largest and fastest growing forces in the economy. But aging in America is unfolding unevenly. Wealth inequality, inadequacies in retirement plan coverage, and rising health and long-term care costs mean that some households are enjoying remarkable financial security in retirement, while others are struggling to afford it at all. And poverty rates among older Americans are rising, the only age group to see an increase in recent years. Here are seven numbers that provide insights into some of the key trends shaping retirement as we head into 2026. 64 is the average age when men quit work, up about 3 years since the mid-1990s, according to the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. The retirement age for women has risen too, to 62.6 in 2024 from about 55 in the 1960s. Although the rapid growth of women in the workforce during the second half of the last century makes comparisons difficult. The average age when people claim Social Security also has risen by about 2 years since the mid-1990s, a trend that persisted even through the pandemic, which many forecasters predicted would push older workers to claim benefits early. A lot of people ended up being able to work from home, and for certain types of workers, that actually allowed them to delay retirement, said Anki Chen, the center's associate director of savings and household finance. However, a sizable group of people on Social Security, 40%, continue to work after claiming benefits, typically for several years. Most of them are lower lifetime earners who claim early and then work part-time. The rest are high earners who often work full-time after claiming near the full retirement age. People do flow in and out of retirement, Ms. Chen said. It might be due to their health or their economic or family situation, but some people find it difficult to actually afford retirement. $45.8 trillion was invested in individual retirement accounts, 401ks, pension funds, and annuities at mid-2025, nearly double the total a decade ago. Strong markets have played a big role in that jump, but rising participation and contributions in 401k plans have also pushed growth. Most of the recent asset growth has occurred in 401ks and IRAs, and IRAs have held more assets than workplace plans for five consecutive years, a shift driven largely by rollovers as baby boomers retire, said Peter Brady, senior economic advisor at the Investment Company Institute. That's where a lot of the action is now, and a lot of the competition as people transition into retirement, Dr. Brady said, referring to efforts by employers to entice retirees to stay in their plans by offering new payout options and financial service firms seeking to capture rollover dollars. 85% of workers with access to a 401k participate, according to Vanguard, up steadily over the past decade. The average participant savings rate in plans administered by Vanguard reached a high of 7.7% of wages in 2024, boosted by automatic enrollment and escalation of contribution rates. These changes have made the 401k system more resilient, with retirement savers staying the course despite upheaval from the pandemic, market gyrations, and inflation over the past 5 years, notes David Stinnett, head of Vanguard's Strategic Retirement Consulting Group. Due to these default features, people just keep going, he said. Combined participant and employer contribution rates have climbed steadily to an average of 12% of wages, up from 10.8% as recently as 2015. And there's been strong adoption of target date funds, which automatically rebalance portfolios to age-appropriate asset allocations. At Vanguard, 84% of participants used target date funds in 2024, up from 69% in 2015. And 59% were invested solely in those funds, Vanguard reports. Here's the rub. Only half of private sector workers are covered by a workplace retirement plan at any given time, mainly because small employers are less likely to offer plans. The coverage gap helps explain why median retirement account holdings for workers 55 to 64 years old was just $185,000 in 2022, according to the Federal Reserve, and the amounts saved by low-income workers have fallen in recent years. There are also persistent disparities in savings by race and ethnicity, with median Black households holding only 14% as much as white households, and Hispanic households just 20% compared with white households. $24,500 is the new maximum 401k contribution for 2026, plus an $8,000 catch-up for workers age 50 and older. For savers age 60 to 63, there's a super catch-up option with a limit of $11,250. Under recent law, catch-up contributions must be made using a Roth contribution option within a 401k for workers earning more than $150,000. The IRA contribution limit is $7,500, with an additional $1,100 catch-up for older savers. $11,000 more in annual premiums is the average hit facing some early retirees as expanded Affordable Care Act subsidies expire. About half of enrollees eligible for subsidies are ages 50 to 64, too young for Medicare. A 64-year-old with income just above the subsidy cutoff of $62,700 would pay $16,500 a year for a benchmark silver plan on average, up from $5,328, according to KFF. It's the pre-Medicare population that will get slammed hardest with higher premiums if the enhanced subsidies don't get extended, said Tricia Newman, Senior Vice President of KFF. The subsidies expired on December 31st. A vote is expected in the House of Representatives this month on a proposed 3-year extension of the tax credits, but the fate of efforts to renew them is uncertain. Medicare costs are also rising sharply. The standard Part B premium is $202.90 per month this year, up nearly 10% and 66% higher than a decade ago. Medicare trustees project another 7.75% increase in 2027 to $218.60 and nearly $350 by 2034. The increases hit lower income beneficiaries hardest. One in four Medicare beneficiaries had incomes below $24,600 in 2024, and half lived on less than $43,200, according to KFF. It's a big share of income, and premiums are rising faster than income, Dr. Newman said. $10,650 a month was the average cost of a private nursing home room in 2024, according to CareScout, a company that publishes an annual study on the cost of long-term care. Per month, assisted living care averaged $5,900, and a full-time home health aide was $6,500, still well beyond what most families have planned for. Nearly 85% of adults over age 65 say they expect to live in their current home for the rest of their lives, according to University of Michigan research, although preparations to do that vary widely. Nobody says, "I can't wait to go to an assisted living facility," said Samir Shah, CareScout's chief executive. But the lingering pressures from the pandemic, the rising cost of care, and greater longevity are all combining to create a very rapid shift away from people going into assisted living facilities. 15% of older adults lived in poverty in 2024. That's up from 10.7% in 2021, and it's the only age group that has seen an increase in poverty. "We're seeing the cost of living getting higher for everyone, especially healthcare costs," said Jane Tavares, a gerontologist at the Leading Age LTSS Center at the University of Massachusetts Boston. "That impacts older adults more because they tend to be sicker and they're living on limited incomes." An index tracked by the center finds that half of people over 65 cannot afford to meet their basic living expenses. And research by the center and the National Council on Aging found that 80% of older households don't have the financial resources to weather major financial shocks such as widowhood, serious illness, or the need for long-term care. The financial struggles extend to middle-class income households. For example, in 2022, households with median total income of $46,200 had just $15,800 in non-housing financial assets that could be tapped in the event of a financial shock. Cuts to food assistance and Medicaid eligibility under the budget legislation signed into law last year by President Trump will worsen the poverty outlook for older Americans, Dr. Tavares said. People need to be aware that there's no fallback when you make these cuts. Shop Talk by Laura Kelly. No shoes. People entering a house party might expect to see shoes by the door. Lately, people entering some startup offices might too. The no-shoes trend is spreading in tech offices, with buzzy startups telling employees to leave their Vans and Uggs at the door. Some cover their offices with soft rugs or offer free slippers. The website noshoes.fun, created by Ben Lang, an employee at the shoes-off startup Cursor, lists a dozen-plus startups with such an approach, including several artificial intelligence firms like Replo and Composite. I've only worked at startups that have a no-shoes-in-office policy, Mr. Lang posted on social media in August. Workers at Spur, which uses AI to check websites for bugs, don branded slides upon arrival at their office in Manhattan, and guests are asked to do the same, said Sneha Shimkumar, a co-founder and the chief executive. The no-shoes policy, she said, makes it feel like a second home for her 10 employees and disarms you in a positive way. Growing up in an Indian family in Singapore, she noted, she often removed shoes in homes and temples to show respect for a space. That slippered employees don't drag in dirt and mud from the street is a plus point, she said. Nick Bloom, a Stanford economist who studies work culture, said the shoes-off trend was partly the pajama economy in action. That is, now the people who worked from home during the pandemic are back in the office, they are bringing their home habits with them. The phenomenon, he added, is consistent with Silicon Valley's 996 culture, in which people have been working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week. If you're at work for 12 hours, he noted, you might as well wear your slippers in the office, as you're not getting to wear them at home. Silicon Valley has long eschewed stuffy dress codes, and coders have been stuffing around their offices and stocking feet long enough that some have welcomed shoes back as they've matured from scrappy small teams. Notion, a software startup founded in 2016, was no shoes until a few years ago. The payments behemoth Stripe, started in 2010, was shoes optional until 2019, the San Francisco Standard reported. A spokeswoman for Gusto, a payroll and human resources startup, said in an email that changing into slippers or slides was an early tradition at the company, which started in a house in Palo Alto, California in 2011. Now, she added, most employees choose to stay in their shoes at work. The shoeless office has even figured in pop culture. An eccentricity of Don Draper's boss in the television show Mad Men is that he walks around his Manhattan advertising agency in sock feet, urging others to remove their brogues when stepping into his office. Still, the practice is unlikely to become the go-to in American offices, partly because, as the New York Times fashion critic Vanessa Friedman has written, feet are among the most controversial, least discussed parts of the body. The recent AI boom is dominated by young people and telegraphing youth, with a rack of shoes that signals frat house or dorm, could be enticing to customers and investors looking to latch on to the next big thing, Dr. Bloom suggested. But the trend may struggle to catch on in more age-diverse workplaces. Young people have great feet, he reflected. Old people don't. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the January 4th issue of the New York Times Business Section. We read from the New York Times Business Section every Thursday at 11 a.m. Your reader has been Kathy. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the USA Today. Following that at 2 o'clock is episode number 6 of Mark Twain by Ron Chernow. Stay with us for these readings and more.